or at least to restrain it. So good to have you on the show, Bruce. As usual, keep up the good work.
Yeah, just I always remember the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, and that's what our duties are as citizens.
Well said.
We've been speaking with Bruce Fein. We will link to his work at RalphNaderRadioHour.com. That's our show. I want to thank our guests again, Professor Adolph Reed and Bruce Fein. For those of you listening on the radio, we're going to cut out here. But for you podcast listeners, stay tuned for some bonus material we call the wrap-up. A transcript of the show will appear on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour website soon after the episode is posted.
For more from Russell Mokhiber, go to CorporateCrimeReporter.com.
And check out Wrecking America, How Trump's Lawbreaking and Lies Betray All, written with Mark Green, and the Ralph Nader and Family Cookbook, Classic Recipes from Lebanon and Beyond. We will link to both of those.
Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, everybody. Well, you've been sitting way too long.
You know what's right and you know what's wrong. You're tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. You just heard the Ralph Nader Hour with Ralph Nader and crew. After a little station business, you'll hear Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund at 7 o'clock. Please stay tuned.
Hi, this is Julian Joiello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website, WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
Now more than ever, we need to hear the truth about the dangers of militant nationalism. On the next Alternative Radio, hear historian Howard Zinn in a classic program on American exceptionalism. That's Alternative Radio, right here on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York.
That's Saturday at 9 p.m.
I love New York.
We love New York.
We've been stuck inside our homes
while our everyday heroes have been working overtime
for New York to reopen
and stay open.
We all need to do our part
and show that we care.
Look, man,
I wear a mask to protect you.
You wear a mask to protect me.
Let's all wear a mask
to stop the spread of coronavirus
and save lives.
When we show up in the mask,
we're showing up for each other.
Show your love for New York.
Because New York loves you.
Only two things scare me, and one is nuclear war.
What's the other?
Excuse me?
What's the other thing that scares you?
Hi, this is Jamie.
Hi, this is Sarah from Brand Van 3000, and you're listening to
WBAI
99.5 FM.
New York?
New York.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction.
fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning we will hear a chat with the great and highly prolific writer Alan Dean Foster, conducted last Thursday, January 21st. But first, a review from Dan Persons.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Power of the Wolf, not exactly a review. We don't have a lot of time, which is unfortunate, since I wanted to do at least a little delving into at least one of the films that's available at the Film Maudite 2.0 Film Festival, which is running now through the 24th, and is available online at filmmaudite.org for free. That's the best price. But them's the breaks, so here are some quick impressions. There's Nina of the Woods, which is kind of like if A24 did Blair Witch Project, which is not a bad thing. There's tons of ambience and a fantastic sound design, but there's a wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey element to it that I felt blunted the impact. Not seriously, just a notch. There's Papi Ramirez versus Giant Scorpions, which director Leslie Rivera pulled from the fest for some sort of distribution reason, hopefully not in a bad way. It's about a stuntman fighting some, giant scorpions, done pretty much solo by Rivera, filming in a North Carolina storage unit. It's crude, it's awkward, its writing won't make Quentin Tarantino sweat, and I'm guessing Rivera knows all that and went ahead anyway, and with such love and energy that it's all kind of adorable. I hope it gets out to the public in some way. Just as frenetic, but much more polished, is Get the Hell Out, a Korean zombie political comedy in which the Korean parliament is invaded by the Walking Dead. And after the last couple of weeks, watching politicians battling fruitlessly mostly a horde of flesh-hungry zombies is kind of purging. So, once again, Nina of the Woods and Get the Hell Out, and many more films can be watched at filmmaudite.org. That's FilmMaudite.org, and they're for free. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
This is Hour of the Wolf. I am with Alan Dean Foster. This is actually our second time doing an interview. The first time was some 19 years ago, and we've had a lot of technical problems here. The other time was face-to-face, and we also almost had a lot of technical problems that had to do with the politics of the convention we were attending.
Oh, yes.
There's always politics there. If you don't know Alan's work, minor things, Star Wars, Star Trek, Alien, and the subsequent two books at least. Lots and lots of stuff that some other people have to end up doing as work for hire, but Alan commands contracts, the real thing, which not everybody does. Coincidentally, we're going to be talking a bit about that. I will be blunt, and I will trust you're not going to be upset if I mention that personally, I like your own universes, like Pip and Flinks. I think that, you know, about 1972, thereabouts, I think was the first thing of yours that I read, and
those were the first things I wrote.
Well, then, so I guess
my first story came out in Analog in June of 1971, and my first novel, which was the first Pip and Flinks book, The Time Crank, came out in 1972. So it's not like you missed anything from the beginning.
There you go. Who was that published by?
It was originally Ballantine Books. was still Ballantine Books. Betty Ballantine bought the book, actually.
I finally got
it. It was then turned over to Judy Lynn Del Rey and Lester Del Rey.
Yeah.
Subsequent to that, but it was Betty who bought the first book.
Wow. Okay. And so that's right there, wonderful pedigree. And what are the others? How many books do you have? Any idea?
It's a little over 130 at this point.
Is that all?
And, you know, short stories and columns and reviews. And, it's been a life of writing, basically. I like telling stories. I'm not a fanatic like Isaac Asimov, who Isaac's idea of a vacation was to go into a room and lock himself in and write. That was his vacation from writing. He was writing some more. But I don't do that. I do take breaks, but I love telling stories.
I think you have surpassed him in terms of a number of works of fiction, because so much of what he wrote was science and nonfiction and autobiography.
That's possible. I don't know. I don't keep track of these things, but people do. So I have to keep numbers handy, I guess. It's just been a fun long ride, and it's interesting. Some people I've learned over the course of my career, you can write something and somebody will love it and somebody else will hate it. And then you'll write something else. And those two people will exactly reverse their opinions. The first one will hate it and the second one will love it. And you're writing the same style and it's still your voice talking. But because of the subject matter or the approach, people will have diametrically opposed opinions about your work. And what that tells you, or tells me anyway, as a creative person, is you might as well do what pleases you, because in the end, you're not going to be able to please anybody no matter what you do.
Now, I mentioned that you wrote a book called Star Wars.
I remember that book.
There was a different name on the cover. Some guy named George Lucas. And I'm friends with Chris Claremont, who wrote the Willow trilogy. Only first book was George Lucas. Second book was George Lucas and Chris Claremont. Third book was Chris Claremont and George Lucas. What was your experience working with Lucas, and how did you feel about not having your name on the cover of, while it may not have been your story, it was still a book that you wrote?
I didn't see George that much. He was busy making this little movie. And if you've ever been around a proper film production, there is literally no time for anything except working on the film. I was frankly astonished that he had any time for me at all. But the couple of brief meetings we had, they went very smoothly. I felt we were on the same page, no pun intended. And it was very, basically, he was a guy who loved, this was my take, he was a guy who loved old serials and science fiction films and comics. And because nobody else was making a movie he wanted to see, he went ahead and made that movie. And we, as far as I know, I never heard any differently. We got along just fine. And he's one of these people who, if I ran into him in a room tomorrow, and I haven't seen him in in decades. But if I ran into him in a room tomorrow, we just start talking. You know how it is with people like that. If you're on the same wavelength, you just pick up conversations from wherever they left off. So that was my experience working with George.
Yeah.
As far as not having my name on the cover of the book, that didn't bother me at all. It's not my universe. I didn't create it. It was in the contract. And if you're a professional, if you sign a contract, you adhere to the terms of the contract. But it never bothered me. I didn't create Star Wars. I had nothing whatsoever to do with the creation or the origination of Star Wars. I just did an adaptation of it into book form. And if George wanted his name on it, that was fine with me.
Now, on the other hand, when he was making Star Wars, he had no idea that it was going to be the phenomenon that it was. So you wrote a book that was sort of a just in case the Empire wouldn't strike back.
That's right. George was, I'm sure George, although we never had time to talk about this, was a great student of Walt Disney. And Walt Disney, of course, is, among other things, known from a business standpoint of view, for looking ahead. And George, I think, was always looking ahead. And the idea with Splinter of the Mind's Eye was, and this was a two-book contract, it was in the same contract as Star Wars, the novelization. I'm sure, George, the idea was that, as I understand it, the first film was not a big success, but not a big failure, he would be able to make a second film, a follow-up film, not necessarily a sequel, but a follow-up film that could be made on a much lower budget, utilizing as many of the costumes and props and backgrounds as possible from the first film. So I was given the task with the second film of writing a book which could be filmed on a low budget, keeping those notions in mind, which is why I set the story on a fog-shrouded planet. Remember, there's no CGI back then. Much easier to film backgrounds when everything's obscured by fog and largely underground. Same thing, it's a lot easier to do tunnels than full backgrounds. And on that basis, I went ahead and wrote the book.
How did you learn the film craft in order to write what was, in essence, an Uber treatment for a movie?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Well, I have a Master of Fine Arts in Theater Arts, specializing in film from UCLA. And so I actually have a degree in this stuff, none of which did me any good, really, when I was getting into writing, because I went a different direction. I didn't go into film. I tried. There were a couple of near misses, as so often happens in the film business. There was a young would-be producer sleeping on his mother's couch in her apartment on Hollywood Boulevard, trying to do the same thing, get into films. And he got a little option money together and optioned a couple of Robert Bloch short stories and put a notice up on the bulletin board in the UCLA film department asking for somebody to try and turn these into screenplays for free. At that point, and I'd always been a fast writer, and I thought this would be good experience. So we got together and I did that. And one of those was almost picked up by ABC Films at that time. It would have been a movie for TV, but it just didn't happen because Bob Bloch's, I didn't know Bob at the time. Bob Bloch's agents wanted too much money for the rights to develop. And so it didn't happen. That young guy sleeping on his mother's couch was Ronald Shusett, who later went on to do, as a producer, mostly Alien, Total Recall, another science fiction fan who got into film in a big way. Mm-hmm. We also got along fine, by the way. So you would see these things crop up along the way. I did a two-part Batman episode for the TV series. I wrote that while I was still at UCLA because my uncle, Howie Horowitz, was the producer of the show. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better end than that. And he read it, and he didn't buy it. But again, it was good experience. It's just like practicing the piano. The more you do, the better, hopefully, you get at it. I wrote a script for a two-part episode for Star Trek, the TV show, the original TV show. And sent it into Norway Productions, which was Gene Roddenberry's production company at Paramount. Got a very nice letter back, which I still have somewhere, saying, thank you very much for your submission. Remember, I'm nobody at this time. I haven't sold anything. Thank you very much for your submission. We like your story very much. Please resubmit for our fourth season. And of course, there was no fourth season.
Right.
That two-part TV episode script was eventually adapted by me for the last two-thirds of Star Trek Log 7, the book. So I did get some use out of it anyway.
Yeah.
I kept trying and trying and trying to get into film and never quite did. Meanwhile, I sold a couple of short stories and then Betty Ballantyne bought the novel. So I ended up going a different direction with my career.
And it's been an immense one and very popular. That also explains why so much of your work is novelizations, not just the work of your own universes that you've created, and there are several of them, but also the Star Trek books, the Alien books, and how many Star Wars books?
Star Wars books, 4.
Okay.
Star Wars, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, the novelization of The Force Awakens, and an original novel set between episodes 1 and 2 called The Approaching Storm.
It would be interesting to see, now that it's an open franchise, if they would revisit those.
How do you mean revisit?
Well, they're doing all kinds of Star Wars stuff. The Mandalorian was but the first. It's about another 8 different storylines that they're pursuing, plus feature films. They created Rogue One, which was placed just before what they renamed Episode 4, A New Hope. I call it Star Wars. So they're doing all of this interstitial work and other series within that universe.
Well, that's the way they should go. I mean, they made the right decision with Rogue One, and The Mandalorian obviously has been a huge success for Disney. And I think that's the direction they should go. The Star Wars universe is large enough to where breaking away from the original storyline is probably, from a story standpoint, the best way to go. They're not encumbered by what's gone before. In fact, I think they should break even further away and forget about, you know, the original stuff altogether. You can only do sequels for so long. Sequels are extremely difficult to do properly.
And prequels.
Yeah, whether they're prequels are even harder because you know what's going to happen afterwards. And with sequels, you at least, particularly if it's a true sequel, you know the major storyline. You probably know a lot of the major characters. And I think going off in a different direction, even more so than The Mandalorian, would probably benefit Disney and the whole Star Wars universe a great deal. But since I don't run a studio or that studio, I can't do that.
You could pitch them.
I did pitch them. I pitched before Episode 8 came out, simply as a fan, really. I wrote a treatment, not a complete treatment. It was weighted towards the front and the back of the story, but it was a full treatment for Episode 9. Trying to retcon, like any fan did, probably like every fan did, mm-hmm. all of the errors and mistakes and problems that materialized in Episode 8. And my agent could not get anybody at Disney to look at it, probably because the film was already in production, but for whatever reason. But I did that, and I posted it online. It's available for anybody to read who wants to. And it's proven interestingly controversial. Some people hate it, and some people really like it. And just what I've mentioned before, no matter what you do, somebody's going to like it, somebody's going to hate it.
There are people
I would have written something.
Mine and vice versa.
Yeah. I would have written something completely different if I had just gone from Episode 7 to Episode 8. But having to go from Episode 8 to Episode 9 entailed dealing with a whole bunch of other things that I would not have put in Episode 8. So you approach it from different ways. But I had fun doing it.
Yeah. So, they are going in all kinds of different directions. They made one solo film, and it didn't do that well, so I don't know if they're going to do more. I liked it, but I may have been the one who did. And it's a huge franchise. It can go splinter off. Even The Mandalorian is going to have its own spinoffs.
Well, that's what you do if you have a franchise that big and you intend to continue with it, is you try different things. I mean, from a studio standpoint, you hope all of them hit. But if one hits and another one doesn't hit, then at least you have options. So I think that's, you know, they're definitely going the right direction with that.
Yeah, I would just personally like to see something with your name on something other than the spine of the book. as far as these universes are concerned. Star Trek is going other way directions as well.
Yes. Well, of course, I did write the treatment for the first Star Trek movie.
Did you?
Yes, that's... You see the film, my name's up there. It says story by it. It's there for about half a second, you know. And
I've forgotten it. So before Robert Wise's name.
That's right. Well, I don't remember the order. Usually they try to put the director up last.
Well, he's the director, so.
Right. I blame the French for that. This whole auteur theory of filmmaking. When it's really a gigantic cooperative enterprise.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, I did do that. It was not a pleasant experience. I'm happy with the result, but I would have been a lot happier if I'd been able to work on the final actual screenplay as opposed to just turning in the treatment.
Yeah.
But it is what it is. The first 5 minutes of that film is all mine. I can claim that.
That's the best part of the film.
I can claim credit for making Kirk an admiral. I thought enough time had passed where he needed a promotion. And, you know, these things, if you don't live in Los Angeles and you're not around the business, you know this.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to embed yourself in the process of making films. If you want to be a country singer, you need to go to Nashville or Austin. If you want to be on the stage, you really should be in New York. There are certain, or London, there are certain centers for these sorts of creative activities. And having made the decision to move to Prescott, Arizona, it becomes difficult to engage properly with the mechanics of the film industry. People can do it. John Huston used to live in Mexico, and nobody seemed to have any problem hiring him. But he was John Huston.
Yeah.
So I'm not, you know, I'm not any Huston. But that's really what you have to do if you want to do it. And I just decided to go a different direction with my life. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, it would be nice to write a film. I've actually written screenplays which have been optioned. They're just not produced. There are, for every screenplay that gets made, there's at least 100 that are actually optioned that still never get made.
Right. Right.
I have one recent one that came very close, was co-written with a wonderful young author named Joel Burke called Olympus, which is about the first settlement on Mars, and was intended to be a U.S.-China co-production shot in China. And it didn't happen, not because of politics. It just, like so many film projects, after the lawyers working on the contract details for something like 6 months, suddenly it evaporated. That's another reason for not going into the film business. It will break your heart.
Yeah. I've never been near any of that. I have done the tiniest bit of stuff in theater, and for God knows what reason, the dice were rolled, and it was tremendously successful, so I quit. I'm back to working for free in radio.
I think it's important to do in your life, if you're very fortunate, to do something that you enjoy doing. There are plenty, I've met plenty of people who made a great deal of money. Not plenty of people. I've met people who made a great deal of money doing stuff that they hated. And every once in a while, one of them picks up and moves to Idaho to do chainsaw sculptures out of trees, because they don't want to be in the stock market anymore, and they don't want to be bankers anymore. And there are things in life besides money. Not to shock anybody, but there really are.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and you are listening to an interview with Alan Dean Foster conducted this past Thursday, January 21st. We now continue.
Now, some people that write novelizations end up, they just write the book. I don't know if they even ever find out that it earns out is the phrase that is used, meaning that it makes the money that the publisher spent, and now profits are rolling in. And then some things that are work for hire, this is especially true in the comics industry, where you can create a character and they can make movies of those characters and those stories that you wrote for comics and never ever receive a penny. I mentioned Chris Claremont, on whom most of the first X-Men movies were based, including Days of Future Past and so forth. And he did not get paid for that because that was the contract. That was the way it was done. Work for hire. You work differently. You work with contracts that hopefully the books earn out, the property earns out, and then people pay residuals. We all know where I'm going with this.
Yes, and we'll get there shortly. I have no doubt. I've done both, actually, Jim. I've had contracts for book adaptations where you get an advance against royalties.
Right.
And if the advance earns out, then you get royalties. And I have also done books where I was given the option to take a lower royalty against a higher advance, or a still higher advance and no royalty. In other words, a flat fee. And I did that on several occasions because the flat fee I felt was sufficient for what I was doing. And when I'm given the choice, I ask to see the screenplay first before I sign the contract. And if I think the film's going to be crap, then I take the higher advance. It's nice to have that choice. Doesn't always happen that way. Usually doesn't happen that way, but it has happened in the past sometimes. For example, on Crow, on the book version of Crow, I read the screenplay, and it's a very pretty movie. It just doesn't make any sense. I read the screenplay, and I thought, well, you know, these people have no idea that there's a difference between science fiction and fantasy. And maybe they think that by combining the two, they'll get the best of both worlds. And, of course, the opposite is true. You get the worst of both worlds because they don't mesh. So I took the higher flat fee that was offered and declined any advance. And that was the right choice on that particular film. But I don't always have that option.
Now, when it comes to... Now, you took that option to get residuals and stuff on at least the Star Wars books and the Alien books.
Okay. Let's do Star Wars first. The first two books, Star Wars and Splinter of the Mind's Eye, as I mentioned earlier, were one contract. And then subsequently with The Force Awakens and The Approaching Storm, those were set contracts. I wasn't given the option there, which was fine. I got an advance against royalties on both of those books. The first two, the second book, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, is an original novel and had a fairly standard original novel setup. I was given an advance, and then the royalty rate was spelled out in the contract. With the first book, the adaptation of the original film, it was originally a flat fee job, which I took anyway because I thought I could do a good job with it, and for various reasons. And we had a story meeting one day at George's. He was renting office space on the Universal Studio lot. There was no such thing as the ranch or Lucasfilm formal offices. And it was myself, George, the producer, Gary Kurtz, and Charlie Lippincott, who was in charge of advertising promotion. And in the course of the conversation, which was to discuss mostly Splinter, because that was my story and had to discuss it with everybody involved. In the course of that, George stopped for a second and said, by the way, I'm giving you a 0.5% royalty on the first book, because I had no royalty on the first book. And I said, you don't have to do that, George. I'm perfectly happy with the contract I signed. He said, no, you did a good job. I want you to have it. And I didn't think much of it at the time. I mean, 0.5% royalty is about as small a royalty as you can get. But when it's a small royalty on what turns out to be a big book, it actually amounts to a few extra dollars, very much worthwhile. So that was very nice of George. You asked how we got along. There's a good example. So I had a 0.5% royalty on the first book, which I didn't originally have in the contract. So that's Star Wars. As far as Alien goes, I've done the novelizations of Alien, Aliens, second film, Alien 3. I did not do the novelization of Alien Resurrection, even though I was asked to, for reasons I can explain later if you want. Many years then passed, and I ended up doing the novelization of Alien Covenant, plus a prequel novel called Alien Origins, or Alien Covenant Origins. The subsequent books, the last two that I mentioned, those were with a different regime, different publisher. Everything's been fine with them. On the first three books, I had a standard novelization, standard advance plus royalty arrangement.
Who was the publisher?
Sorry?
Who was the publisher?
The original publisher was Warner Books.
Okay. And what then, Star Wars books?
The original publisher with all the Star Wars books was Del Rey from the very beginning.
Okay. So that is so.
But subsequent to the Disney Corporation's purchases of both 20th Century Fox, which then had regained the rights to the Alien books, and Lucasfilm, which had the rights to all the Star Wars books prior to The Force Awakens and such, things became complicated. Royalty-wise, the subsequent books, in the case of Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and The Approaching Storm, there's never been a problem with that as far as royalties. And with the subsequent Alien books, which are published by Titan Books, Alien Covenant and Alien Covenant Origins, not a problem with that. The problem arose, and I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of this problem because it's been all over the news in the last few months, because of the purchase by Disney of Fox and Lucasfilm. And when you're trying to mesh not two, but three huge entertainment conglomerates or any two or three businesses, things sometimes get lost in the shuffle. And in the case of the books that I just mentioned, those original books, their royalty reports apparently got lost in the shuffle for rather a number of years, to the point to where it became more than a private issue. Not that anybody wanted that. I certainly didn't want that. Nobody wanted it. But sometimes until you shine a light on something, it stays in the dark.
Yeah, and you'd been talking with them by mail and various means about the reports and the residuals for quite some time before you discussed it with anybody else. Other than your agent?
Well, my agency was, and my agents were, and they couldn't really get an answer back from Disney. Again, you're dealing with lower-level people at a giant corporation. This thing is not unheard of, but it's not good. And basically couldn't get an answer, and finally did get an answer, the short version of which was essentially, yes, we bought 20th Century Fox and Lucasfilm. We acquired their assets, we did not acquire their obligations. And this speaks to a point of not just copyright law, but a much wider range of law in general. It's not a good precedent. And obviously, we challenged it. And when nothing happened for a little while, then the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America, SIFWA, got involved. And the only way to get a response, it was determined, was to go public with it, which, again, nobody wanted. But and suddenly it went viral within 24 hours. And lo and behold, subsequent to that, some serious talk ensued between the Virginia Kid Agency, which is my agency and always has been, and Disney, and things are progressing. And that's all I can say at this point.
Yeah, this is something that is in progress. We can mention that there was a very interesting article in the Wall Street Journal. And we can also mention that there was a three-way video with you, Mary Robinette Kowal, of the science fiction fantasy writers of America, and Von Hansen, who is a principal at the Virginia Kid Agency. And anybody who wants to see that can go on Facebook to the SFWA group. I know it's Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, but they only added the fantasy later, so it's still SEFWA, S-F-W-A. And it's a 25-minute video, and it lays things out fairly well. It's including, where necessary, some no comments, because this is a legal work in progress.
Yes, and as I say, as they would say in Hollywood, my people are talking to the mouse's people. And
but things are moving. There was a long period where nobody was squeaking.
Yeah. Hopefully this will all be resolved very shortly.
Good.
And when it is, it will be announced. But sometimes you have to be in a position sometimes to where you can speak up. And apparently there have been other writers in similar situations who are also now being communicated with. And so on that basis alone, it's been an awkward but useful discussion.
And this has happened, I think, to all kinds of writers. For some reason, particularly genre writers. I know it's happened a lot with Westerns and certain mysteries, but it's also just happened to lots of people who were with smaller publishers like Lancer Books, if there's anybody in the world who remembers them, and they got bought. I don't think anything ever happened to the titles they owned, but books continued to be sold, and the purchaser of those companies did not think that they had the obligation to pay out on the contracts that the original contracts with writers. And this is, by the way, I understand, not true only in writing. I understand this is a problem that happens in many industries, that a company gets bought and the purchaser doesn't believe that they owe the obligations.
Well, there are terrible things that happen. Most notably, you'll have a corporate raider come in. They'll buy a company. They'll raise money. They'll usually borrow money. They'll raise money and they'll buy a company, and then they will sell off the most valuable assets of that company. The money will go to quote unquote shareholders. And then what's left, they'll declare bankruptcy. That will usually include the pension fund for the unfortunate workers from that company.
Yeah.
And the people who bought it in the first place will depart with a nice profit, leaving behind the detritus of the company and the lives and pensions of the people who work for it. This happens every day.
It's called asset tripping, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a terrible, terrible thing.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about with regards to books is essentially that, the asset being the writer's work, on a much, much smaller scale. If you're going to deal with a small publisher, for example, could give you many, many examples of this sort of thing happening, because people who write are anxious and desperate to be published. There was an outfit called Aeolian Press, which did hardcover editions of the Star Trek blogs, which I wrote. Nobody even knew about them until somebody saw some of the books. They were very nice books. They were done without dust jackets on library quality paper. But they never, not only did they not pay royalties to Del Rey Books, which owned the rights, so that Del Rey could then pay a portion of that to the writers, they didn't even announce that they were doing this. They just went ahead and did these books. It was like somebody doing self-binding and printing out of their house.
Yeah.
And when they were discovered, of course, they were shut down. But nobody knows, they didn't get off with tens of millions of dollars, but they must have made some money off those books. I know a lot of them were sold to libraries. The libraries had no idea what they were buying. You can still find these books online and in places. They're very nice books. But the person who, quote unquote, published them, as far as I know, never paid anybody concerned who actually owned the rights, whether it was Del Rey Books or Paramount or the writers or anybody else.
Yeah, and they have their market set up for libraries, which is a great market. If you could just sell to libraries as a publisher, and they can command large prices for books by the educational nature of what they're doing, they charge more for the book itself. So libraries pay out, they get grants, and the publisher gets a lot of money. It would be nice if they owned what they're selling.
There's an excellent publishing house, I guess it's still in business in Britain, called Severin House. And they were set up, as I understand it originally, to publish books exclusively for libraries. So you have acid-free paper and nice bindings and nice dust jackets. And somewhere along the line, they discovered that science fiction readers, particularly, would pay money, same money, for these books, because in a lot of cases, they were the only hardcover editions of these books. They've done a number of my books that are, in some cases, the only hardcover editions, and very nice books indeed. So that was, I guess, a little subsidiary stream of income for the publisher outside of their sales to libraries. Publishing industry is fascinating, just fascinating. All these little things that you're not aware of unless you're closely involved. People just buy a book and assume, you know, that's it. They all come from Random House or Simon & Schuster or Harper's, and all kinds of interesting little things that go on that people are unaware of unless you're a collector.
Right. But there is one other thing at the base of all of this, and that is to quote Vaughn Hansen, who I'm sure, you know, your agent, who I'm sure is not the first person to say this, a contract is a contract is a contract.
Well, one hopes. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, but I mean, we've had four, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, you're one of the first people in a position to actually litigate. Well, not litigate. We're not at that stage. To argue and negotiate this issue.
Didn't want to. It was pressed upon me, or upon us, I should say, with regards to the agency. It's one thing if people will argue with you about, well, you're owed this much money, or you're not owed this much money, or you were owed money last year, but you're not owed money next year. It's a long way from that to saying you're not owed anything for the work you did. If it's in the contract, the first line of the original Alien contract, the very first Alien book, says that this contract shall be binding upon the author, and then my name in parentheses, and the publisher, Warner Books in parentheses, and their heirs and assigns. And it's not complicated. It's not complicated. You just go down the line and find out who the current heir and assign is for that property. And if you have that in your contract, there shouldn't be any argument or disagreement or disputation about the details. But, you know, in this particular case, there was. But as I say, we are talking, and I hope very much that it's all resolved, say, within the next month, certainly.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that, because this has been going on for at least 2 years, right?
Yeah.
There was a great deal of time. I mean, the pandemic may slow things down, but this has been going on for over 2 years. And for a long time, nobody was even responding to requests for information.
Well, it's all being sorted out, and hopefully it will be consigned to the realms of contract history very shortly now.
But I'm hoping that history, I'm not just hoping, I believe this is an important history. I think that this is going to end up setting a precedent for a lot of people to whom this has happened. I know Mary Robinette Kowal has put out a call to writers that if you're within the science fiction fantasy world, you should talk to them. You should check out an organization called Writers Beware, which gives out a lot of very good information about a lot of dastardly and less than dastardly stuff. But it happens to manufacturers. It happens to a lot of people. And I hope you are setting precedent for setting these issues aright.
Well, I think it will. It shouldn't have to be. It shouldn't even be an issue. But sometimes opinions on contracts diverge, and you need to discuss them and bring them to a point to where both parties agree. And the end result is usually that both parties benefit from that agreement. That's the way you want it to be anyway.
Yeah.
Already, you know, I can't speak for other writers, but I know there are other writers who are involved in this now. And as I say, hopefully it'll all be settled in a very short period of time.
I'm very pleased to hear that. Before we change the subject, anything else on this specific thing that you'd like to mention or go on about? I recommend to people to go to Facebook and watch that video.
It's very informative. I would second that recommendation. The only thing I can add is that pursuant to our discussion about film and TV adaptations, I've been doing this for a very long time, obviously. Yeah. And I often get asked a lot of the same questions. And there will come a point in time where I won't be around to answer these questions. It finally occurred to me that I ought to jot them down so that when I'm not around to answer the questions, people can still read the answers to them. So a book coming out in April from Centipede Press called The Director Should Have Shot You, which details my involvement with film and television adaptations, starting with the very first one, Luana in 1973.
I think that could be made into a movie, by the way.
Luana? Oh, the story of Luana, of course, is kind of funny.
Your whole story with the director said...
the director should have copied.
Yeah,
people will find answers to a lot of the things and more exposition on subjects we've been talking about in that book. It's not a long book, but it's everything I could remember about every film that I ever adapted into book form. I didn't take notes when I was doing these things, but put down everything I could remember in relation to every film there is.
It's very funny. So April. You have an in with your agents. So.
Okay.
Actually, Virginia, so go that far back. What area have you not delved in your writing that you would like to?
I tried, I've written one mystery novel and several novelettes and novellas featuring the same character, but it's science fiction. The main character is a detective. So even though there's the usual mysteries involved, I don't consider that pure detective fiction. I did try one once. It's called Raw on the Road. Turned out to be short. It's about 66,000 words. Needs to be expanded upon and have work done on it. And I might go back and revisit that again. But basically, I've explored every aspect of writing that I really wanted to do. I have a poem coming out in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. That'll be a first. Not the first published poem, but the first one I've been paid for. And as you probably know, in April, I started writing orchestral music, which is something I always wanted to try.
No, I was not aware of that. Tell me.
Yeah, it was complicated by the fact that, A, I have no formal musical instruction in composition, and B, I can't play an instrument. So that kind of slowed me up for a few years. But some software has come out in the last few years that if you persevere enables you to do that sort of thing. I always heard music in my head sometimes when I was writing fiction. And now I have a way of jotting it down. I've done some short pieces and three symphonies, and I'm working on a symphonic poem right now. And whether anybody ever plays it or not, I don't know. But it's there. And I'll throw that back into whatever form my legacy takes. And somebody will discover it in 100 years and play it, and I won't get to hear it. But, you know, what the heck? At least I know I did it.
Where can people find it? Is it in Shermer's? Has it been published at all?
No, none of it's been published. It hasn't even been submitted for publication. I wouldn't know how to do that. I could find out. But I'll get to that point maybe one of these days. There is on my Facebook fan page, right, which Open Road Media, one of my publishers, runs. My favorite band is a Finnish symphonic metal band, which is a genre a lot of people in the United States aren't even aware of, but it's wonderful music. My favorite band's called Nightwish. So back when I was getting started doing this, there are six members in the band, and I did little 1.5-2 minute musical impressions using the orchestra for each one of them. That's on the Facebook page if people want to listen to something. I hope I've gotten better since then. But at least if people want to get a basic idea of what I've been trying to do, that's up on that Facebook page, and they can listen to that.
This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and you've been listening to an interview with Alan Dean Foster conducted last Thursday. I should say this is only about 2/3 of our chat, and if you'd like to hear or watch the entire piece, visit us on Facebook in the Hour of the Wolf group. By the way, this is approximately the 50th anniversary of this program, and I will be posting an essay on the history of this show in that same group. Right now, in the background, you're hearing part of the fourth movement of Allen's Symphony No. 3, Opus 7, using software to synthesize the music as he imagined it. We will be back next Saturday morning at 7 a.m. with Sarah Langan, whose brilliant writing is often compared to that of Shirley Jackson. Stay tuned for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Good morning.
WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. You just heard Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund. After a little station business, you'll hear Any Saturday with David Rothenberg at 8 o'clock. Please, stay tuned.
Hey, Harry, old buddy, old pal.
So I want you to be my buddy.
Why can't we be friends?
You've got a friend.
Friends or buddies, as we like to refer to you as here at WBAI. Either way, we invite you to join us and become a member of this fine radio station. We want to partner with you, but we want to do it in the least imposing and most painless way possible. Here's the deal. It's called the Buddy Pledge. You give us your support for 12 months, and we give you access to the most eclectic music, as well as the best and thought-provoking news, talk, and community affairs. Sound good? See it in your heart to pledge a minimum of $10 per month. Each payment will automatically be deducted from your credit or bank statement, so there's no reminders needed. Just join us for a one-year membership and go online at www.give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org and be part of our vibrant community. WBAI New York.
I believe that we have got to mobilize a larger movement to reclaim the democracy.
Radio broadcaster Bob Law.
Some of y'all have underestimated the value and the appeal of white supremacy. And you have no idea how strong white privilege and white supremacy is.
Tune in to From the Streets with Bob Law, which gives voice to a wide range of black and progressive political and cultural perspectives. That's 11 to noon Saturdays here over listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Hello, I'm Isaac Ferguson. I'm inviting you to tune in on Saturday at 4 to 6 p.m. for Caribbean Voices and Beyond, when we will bring you news, views, and important issues affecting the Caribbean community in particular and the immigrant community in general. Tune in 4 to 6 p.m. to Caribbean Voices and Beyond on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the Internet.
Saturday night at 7 p.m. on WBAI Playhouse, tune in for a twisted tale of the secret life of nuns. It's set in a crumbling convent school on the verge of insolvency when this young postulant begins to display heavenly powers.
I have saintly visions, hear heavenly voices, and have the power to heal.
A reporter turned movie producer tries to buy the rights to her story, but the Mother Superior, played by Charles Bush, refuses to put profit over prayer.
The financial rewards you could reap from this film sale could solve all of your problems.
I will not exploit that young girl for my own ends.
That's The Divine Sister, written and starring Charles Bush, who wrote Vampire Lesbians of Sodom and The Tale of the Allergist's Wife. He puts on a nun's habit and stars as the leading lady in this L.A. Theater Works production of The Divine Sister, Saturday, 7 p.m. on listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
He's cool. He's exciting.
This dude is bad.
He's sexy. Okay, maybe not. He's a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
He's Tony Ryan on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. He's got both.
Break him with the sound of the trumpet.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, I can dig it, yeah.
He's got classic soul. He's okay. I can't think of anything else.
I'm Tony Ryan. Tune in Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Soul Central Station with Tony Ryan.
99.5 WBAI.
It's autumn. The birds and ear massage are migrating to Sundays, 6 to 8 a.m. Ear massage, sound, spoken word, a bit of opera, and maybe music you never heard before, including the ever-popular Bird of the Week. Ear massage between Jeff Brady in other news and your morning Ursae with James Ursae here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Ear massage, Sundays, 6 to 8 a.m.
Hi, this is David Amram. You're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 on your FM dial, and keep on listening.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong if you start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, little more fortissimo.
I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented, I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me, I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied, he demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail, I lands on his head. He flips his head, I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing south to the border down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You gotta start off each day with a song. Oh boy, you're singing now. Even when things go wrong. Oh, Jimmy, you're a wow. You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now, you know that, so you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Start off each day with a song.
Mr. Durante ushering in January 23rd, Saturday, January 23rd. I'm David Rothenberg. The program is Any Saturday on listener sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in the city of New York. And this was the week that was. Of the many emails that I received on Wednesday, one said, this is what hope looks like. Let us hope. The stock market went up that day higher under Biden than it ever was under Trump. So that dispels one myth, doesn't it? One of the things that was struck me on mornings, I watch different things to pick me up on Netflix. And I watched the Dave Chappelle. I watched a few Dave Chappelle comedy things. Mr. Chappelle, it was reported yesterday, has shown up positive. Let's hope that he's well. And that pulls through this. He's funny, but he's also a social commentator in the tradition of George Carlin and Richie Pryor. He makes us laugh, but he makes us think. And one of them, he said, Donald Trump has made me a patriot. He said, I know all that's wrong here, but he makes me look around and appreciate what I love about America, and I don't want him to destroy it. And I started making a list of things. I've been called a kvetch and a complainer about things that I don't like in our city, our state, our country. And I think that's part of the joy of being in a democracy, is that you can try to make it better. You have a voice to make it better. And I started listening. What are the things that I really love? And I love my involvement with the Fortune Society. I've been blessed for 52 years to be involved with an organization that gives hope and promise and to people who have been written off by the system. And I love being a part of that. I feel the same way about this radio, this cockamamie radio station, with all its faults and all its shortcomings. It gives me and many others a voice that otherwise wouldn't be heard, and you're an opportunity to hear us. So I love that. I love walking around my neighborhood and just watching the kids in the schoolyard and the dogs smelling each other's hind knees and people rushing in and out. It's I don't know why it gives me such joy, but it does. The sense of life and energy in the West Village. I loved when I lived in Colorado, the mountains that shadowed over Denver. I loved being up in Maine for four summers working and down at Bucks County on the canal after a performance when I worked down there. And I loved being in Santa Fe and San Antonio, also a city with canals, and down in Florida and the Keys. So there's so much in America that I cherish, as well as the people. And I think more than anything else, the people in New York City. I've often talked about riding the subway as like being in a Fellini movie, watching the different ethnic and religious groups, watching a kid with dreads sitting next to an old Orthodox Jew reading his whatever it is he's reading, and a Chinese couple sitting next to them, and young hippies. And we all coexist in New York, and we have our problems, but we, more than that, we coexist. And I love all that. And that makes me, as an activist, as one who has sat in, has marched, has protested, I still love it here. And that's probably why I was in a rage for 4 years that was alleviated on Wednesday when a voice of calmness came in. I'm not wild about Joe Biden, never have been. I think he's a good, decent human being. That's what I said it over a year ago, and many of the BAI listeners screamed at me because I felt that he was the person most likely to defeat Trump, that I didn't think Bernie or Liz Warren, people closer to me politically, I didn't think they could win. We're too fractured a country, and the calmness and moderation of Joe Biden was, I thought, paramount, because I thought the single most important issue was not health care, was not climate change, was defeating Donald Trump, because we would never get to climate change or health care or the children at the border if we didn't defeat Donald Trump. We wouldn't, the pandemic clearly emerged as the issue that was paramount for us. And now we've seen what a disaster he was just in the distribution of the vaccine. So the single most important issue for me continues to have been the defeat of Donald Trump, so that we can begin to talk about the issues that many BAI people think are so paramount. And then how close we came. This is on the front page of the Times today. The print is small and my eyes are aging, so I hope I can read it. But, you know, you continue to be shocked. This is the front page of the Times. The Justice Department, I'm having so much trouble with the light here. Well, the essence of it is Barr left because he saw what was coming, and he did whatever he believed, he didn't want to be involved in the legal aspects of it. And they appointed the unassuming lawyer who worked alongside Jeffrey Clark had been devising ways to cast doubt on the election results and to boast to Mr. Trump's continuing legal battles and the pressure of pressure on Georgia politicians, because Rosen Rosen, who was the acting attorney general, because Rosen had refused the president's entreaties to carry out those plans. Mr. Trump was about to decide whether to fire Rosen and replace him with Clark. The department officials, this is the attorney general's office, convened on a conference call, then asked each other, what will you do?